Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. James Baldwin was one of the most powerfully eloquent and powerfully complex thinkers of the civil rights movement. The author of Go Tell It on the Mountain and The Fire This Time, he fearlessly challenged passive notions of what racial equality should look like in a just society. Listen for a moment to Baldwin on August 28, 1963, the day of the historic March on Washington.
The importance of the day in my mind is that for the first time in our history, and the first time in 100 years, the nation shows some signs of really dealing with its central problem instead of, as it has done for 100 years, avoiding it, evading it, denying it, lying about it, pretending it did not exist. The country will have to now go to work, and very hard work, very dangerous work, to change itself, to achieve this dream that Martin was talking about. And if we do not achieve this dream, we have no future at all.
Well, years later, that tone of cautious hope soured into some disillusionment with America. And in that arc, the arc of Baldwin's life, his thinking, his writing, we find lessons for today. So this hour on Point, the legacy and the lessons of James Baldwin. And in order to guide us through these lessons, we're joined by Eddie Cloud. He's the distinguished professor, university professor of African American Studies at Princeton. His new book is Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Professor Cloud, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted.
You know, I'd like to spend this hour sort of walking through Baldwin's life and his writings kind of in chapters headlined by some of his key ideas that you discuss in your book. So that's the construct I'm going to use. So if I may, the first chapter is after times. This is a phrase that Baldwin himself used. What were Baldwin's after times?
So it's not a phrase that Baldwin uses, a phrase that I gather, that I get from Walt Whitman.
Got it.
Okay. And Whitman's after times is, he's trying to think about what the nation is doing, how it's morally vacuous after the tumult of the Civil War. We're on the cusp of the Gilded Age, and he sees rampant greed and narcissism and an evisceration in some ways of the public good as people kind of descend into selfishness. So the after times is that period when one world is dying, one way of life is dying, and another way is coming into being, and we're turning our backs on something. And so Baldwin's after times, as I understand it, or as I argue in the book, is this period right after the Civil War, right after the Civil Rights Movement, when the nation is beginning to turn its back on what the Civil Rights Movement, what the Black freedom struggle of the mid-20th century called for, and a new world is coming into being, and that world, of course, would be consolidated by 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan.
So then do you see the United States as still in Baldwin's after times?
Well, you know, it's fascinating, right? So we've been living in the age of Reagan since 1980 in some ways. Some would argue that it actually started with the administration of Jimmy Carter. But I think, you know, with the election of Barack Obama, there was this sense that the nation had turned a corner, that the reality of race and how it had in some ways overshadowed and overdetermined our commitment to democracy, that somehow we had left something behind. But of course, right after Obama was elected, we got the vitriol of the Tea Party. We had voter ID laws and voter suppression. And then we elected Donald Trump. And so in some ways, we are in our after times. And Donald Trump is his avatar.
But of course, in between came Barack Obama, Professor.
Exactly. Pinched between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump is Barack Obama. Ironies of all ironies.
Well, you know, I know you have a quite a few thoughts about the Obama presidency, and I want to hold those for a little bit later. I will come back to them because I think they're quite important in terms of your thoughts, your life, and the lens of James Baldwin as well on America now. So hold that thought about President Obama. But so let's dive more into grappling with James Baldwin's view and his thoughts on the America that he lived in. Because we played that first bit of tape from 1963, and you hear him being somewhat hopeful, but also cautious at the same time. Mm-hmm. Now, the very next year, in 1964, he wrote this essay called The White Problem. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that essay, and then I know you have a little excerpt from it. I'd love to hear you read it.
Right. I mean, I think at the heart of The White Problem is something that is kind of Baldwin's revolutionary inversion. And we see it in The Fire Next Time, right? Because white America's answer to the March on Washington, let's be clear, the country's answer to the March on Washington was the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, mm-hmm. the murder of those four little girls. And it was devastating for not only Jimmy, but it was devastating for King, it was devastating for the movement. But at the heart of Baldwin's corpus is this radical inversion. And what do I mean? That the problem isn't us. That what's ailing the country, what at the heart of this race problem isn't some pathology on the part of Black people. The problem is actually white people, right? And their belief in this idea that because they're white, that they ought to matter more. And that they've built a world predicated upon that belief, and that they've socialized their children and our children in a world that values certain people because of the color of their skin and devalues others. And so the white problem is a kind of explicit rendering of that, right? That if we're going to resolve the problem of race in the country, we can't say to Black people, you must do X, Y, and Z, because Black people are busy trying to navigate what white folk have done to them. And so Baldwin, you know, gives it back to them, right? He gives the problem back to white America and says that, you know, we have to grapple with this on a different plane, on a different level, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'd love to hear you read some of how Baldwin actually talks through this idea in the excerpt, if you could.
Yeah, there's this problem. He says, the people who settled the country had a fatal flaw. They could recognize a man when they saw one. They knew he wasn't anything else but a man. But since they were Christian, and since they had already decided that they came here to establish a free country, the only way to justify the role this chattel was playing in one's life was to say that he was not a man. For if he wasn't, then no crime had been committed. That lie is the basis of our present trouble. I love that quotation.
That's from The White Problem, published in 1964 by James Baldwin. So the lesson then for today, because we're talking 50 years later now.
Right. So there's so much that follows from that lie, right? So if we've built a country predicated upon the idea that white people matter more than others, and that belief and that idea evidences itself in our dispositions, in our characters, in our practices, it shapes our social, political, and economic arrangements, we protect that belief with a series of lies, with an architecture of lies that protects our innocence. And so here we are in this moment, right? In this moment where demographic shifts are putting pressure on how we imagine the country, you know, those commercials on television with those racially ambiguous children and same-sex marriages, right? There's this cultural, unsettling that's happened. And people are worried about, well, is this the America that I know? And so there's this clamoring for a different way of imagining who we are. And yet folk are doubling down on the lie. They're telling themselves the story that this is a white nation, the vein of old Europe. They're defending, some of them, the Confederate monuments, which in some ways those monuments are monuments to a lie called the Lost Cause. They're insisting in some ways, as Senator Tom Cotton did so recently, and as a description of the founders, that the founders saw slavery as a necessary evil. And in saying that, in some ways, he was trying to absolve them of the cruelty and barbarity of the institution. So we're in the moment where we're grappling with the implications of the lies that we've told ourselves in light of, in some ways, the monstrous implications of how we live our lives.
Mm. Now, at the time when Baldwin wrote this about the lie is the basis of our present trouble, yeah. How was that? How did people respond to that challenge? That he's asking America to have the scales fall from its eyes.
Baldwin was always kind of willing to tell the country what it did not want to hear. And so, you know, he's the darling of the New York chattering classes in some ways. You know, Baldwin's career emerges or takes off as he's in some ways lifted up by New York intellectuals. There is a celebration not only of Go Tell It on the Mountain and Notes of a Native Son, but, you know, The Fire Next Time catapults him into, you know, onto the national stage as the most insightful critic of America, American democracy and race. By 64, people are saying that he's become bitter. His rage has overwhelmed. And folks don't quite know what to do with him. And of course, by the time, Blues for Mr. Charlie is produced on stage, and Baldwin's rage and anger, his prophetic righteous indignation, It scorches the ground. It leaves no one untouched. So there is a sense, as one biographer says, by 1963, Baldwin's voice broke because people are just disagreeing with his politics.
I mean, hearing his voice broke, but broke how? Because what you just read to us, he wrote in 64, was published in 64, retains a kind of unique power to this day.
Yeah, I think there's this assumption that, you know, he became too polemical, that his art was subsumed by his political choices, that he had turned his back on being the kind of aesthete who was not in some ways driven by the propaganda or the polemics of a political moment. So James Campbell, I think, in that moment is trying to suggest that, you know, the discontent of the young activist, like John Lewis and others, had overwhelmed Baldwin's aesthetic choices.
Well, we are talking with Eddie Gloud. He's author of the new book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're spending this hour exploring the life and legacy of James Baldwin. Eddie Gloud joins us to do that. He's chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of the new book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Professor Gloud, part of me wants to spend quite a bit of time just going, like, ticking through Baldwin's biography about where he grew up and a young man. And his life and thinking is so massive that we can't achieve both. So I'm just going to recommend to listeners that they should read your book and do some homework on Baldwin's early biography, because I still want to just dig into the ideas, because it's the ideas that have survived. Obviously, his own passing in 1987, if I remember correctly. So so we talked about, you know, you brought up this phrase, after times. And then we talked about James Baldwin's sort of telling or identifying of the lie. Now, he also then, a couple of years later, starts writing about, or at least in one of his writings, he talks about the dangerous road, or the concept of a dangerous road. What did he mean?
Well, you know, he's thinking about Dr. King in those early, you know, he had interviewed Dr. King early in the movement, and he saw with the student movement in the 1960 with the student sit-ins and the freedom rides, as the students, these young people like John Lewis, like the late John Lewis, who were injecting themselves into the movement and radicalizing it in some ways, that they were going to confront King and others with a choice, that they're here were the children of these bourgeois black folk forcing a kind of reckoning with the country, and that King would be caught between the crosshairs of the radical demands of this younger generation and an old politics that sought to contain how we imagined racial equality in the country. And so The Dangerous Road was an essay that he wrote, I think in 61 or something like that, about Dr. King. And part of what I'm trying to do in the book is to say that in this piece, this interesting relationship with Dr. King and how he's accounting for the movement that King represents offers us lessons for our own moment. Because by the time King's assassinated in 68, the things that Baldwin worried about in this early essay had come true. And that when they were speaking in, you know, California or in New York at events trying to raise money for the Poor People's Campaign, both were trying to narrate the movement and to deal with what was in fact what could be seen as a judgment that the movement was on teetering on failure, that the country had decided to betray it all. So that was The Dangerous Road in some ways. And of course, it has something to do with the complexity of history in all of us.
So are you concerned about the potential echoes of that now?
Yeah, this is why I wrote the book. Yeah, I had to figure out how to deal with my despair, how to deal with my disillusionment in a moment of another moment of betrayal. So here we are, you know, we elect Barack Obama, the country is euphoric. My son is raised, he comes of age in a moment with black family in the White House, and then black people are being killed in the streets. Black Lives Matter erupts, and then the country elects Donald Trump, and we see all of this, you know, nonsense, people doubling down on the ugliness. I had to figure out how to manage my rage and to hold on to my faith that we could be otherwise. And Baldwin's writing offered me resources to think about our current moment in that way.
You know, you had mentioned Representative Lewis, and this is bringing to mind a conversation that we had on this show the Monday after John Lewis died. And South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn joined us, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson joined us as well. And it was absolutely fascinating, because in their voices and the things that they chose to talk about, regardless of whatever questions I asked, they really went out of their way to want, they themselves brought up their concerns about a generational divide all over again. Amongst those people who seek to further the cause of civil rights in America now. They talked about centering the importance of continue to center the importance of politics, about not wanting the language of activists to be hijacked, in James Clyburn's words, by bad headlines, because he had experienced that in the 60s. So I do think we see this. The generational divide all over again. So tell me, how do you see? Are there lessons we can take from Baldwin in terms of did he ever feel like that could be resolved?
Well, you know, he sided with the young folk, right? In some ways, in one biographer, David Lemming, says that he joined CORE and SNCC, or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or the Congress for Racial Equality. So those younger students who were clamoring for more radical politics, who pushed for a different kind a different kind of agenda in some ways around the issue of racial equalities. Remember when John Lewis spoke at the March on Washington, Archbishop O'Boyle, from Washington, D.C., wanted to censure him. He thought that Lewis's speech as chair of SNCC was too radical. That famous quote that people are talking about, you know, are constantly replaying about John Lewis and patience. He, in the initial version of the speech, patience, he writes, is a nasty and dirty word. Right. So it's funny to hear Representative Clyburn, and Jim and I are good friends, and Reverend Jackson, whom I love dearly. But, you know, they didn't sound like that when they were in SNCC. I just want to be clear. Mm-hmm. When Jim Clyburn didn't sound like that in SNCC. Jesse Jackson has a different trajectory. But, you know, part of what, these young folk are doing are trying to change the frame of how we imagine, for example, policing in the country. To get caught up in the phrase is to, in some ways, and I'll say this very quickly, we knew people were engaging Black power in bad faith. They dismissed the phrase. They thought it was Black violence, just like they dismissed the phrase Freedom Now. They said it was bad. So the idea of saying that defund the police means to just simply defund the police, and without taking seriously what the phrase actually means, is a bad faith gesture. And so when you concede to the terms of that, then you're caught. You're already on that terrain. And so I think in one way to hear what you're saying is to in some ways give voice to a generational divide that's making mm-hmm. itself known in our politics.
Yeah, just one little coda sure. to the story about Congressman Lewis and that speech in 63 about when he said patience. I know you've heard him say this before too, that I think he said that it was it Dr. King or A. Philip Randolph? I think it was Dr. King who told him, you know, that the original language that he wanted to use didn't sound like you, John. And that was the encouragement or nudge, Kingian nudge that he got to change the language. So
yeah, he was. They all had him hemmed up. It was a hard time.
Now, I want to just ask you a quick question.
Sure.
Speaking about different aspects of the Black community, about the civil rights movement, then and now. We should be honest about the complexity with which those different parts of the community saw James Baldwin at the time. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, James Baldwin, this queer Black man, right, from Harlem, aesthetic, an artist prone to the dramatic, in some ways was misfitted, right? So King and others kind of... you know, they weren't quite comfortable with him, as Baldwin relates in No Name in the Street in 1972. And I think it had not only, I think that discomfort was not only rooted in a Baldwin sexuality, but it was also, it also evidenced a kind of class difference. You know, King came from preacherly royalty in Atlanta. Baldwin was from Harlem. He was from the ghetto, and he wasn't from Sugar Hill in Harlem. Right. So he's not from the place where Langston Hughes and W.B. Du Bois. No, he's from the hood. And you know, he was educated in the streets of Harlem, in the streets of Greenwich Village, in the alleys of Paris and the like. So there's a different class inflection. And then, of course, when Black Power hits, Baldwin never betrays those young folk. And I should say this really quickly, Magna, that there's this in our history, we tend to read Black Power and the Civil Rights Movement as if they're wholly separate moments and not really understand that some of the people who cried, who shouted Black Power, were some of the people who risked their lives nonviolently in the bowels of the South. Many of the young people that Baldwin saw in Mississippi and Alabama and in Georgia and in Florida, many of those young people who risked everything, took the billy club of Jim Clark and others, right, saw the country turn its back, and they cried Black Power, the same people. And so when Baldwin, tells the story of Black Power in that moment, right, he embraces them. He understands that these are our children, but a kind of hyper-masculinity, right, that's often a part of that politics is very unsettled by Baldwin's presence. A kind of faith in what Baldwin called that mystical Black BS, right, put Baldwin in a kind of critical position with some of the proponents of Black Power. So he was always... in some ways, but not of, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So forgive me for not knowing this, but did that aspect of who he was and how the Black, various components of the Black community view him, did that make it into his writing?
Oh, sure. You know, so the second novel, The second novel is Giovanni's Room. And Giovanni's Room is a novel about love, but it's about same-sex love. You know, he wouldn't describe it as same-sex love. He says it's about love. You know, you love whom you love, right? You love who you love, right? And, you know, that's the novel that followed Go Tell It on the Mountain. And, you know, Baldwin, when I interviewed Angela Davis for this book, she said in so many ways he was out there by himself for so long. And Baldwin, who wrote Giovanni's Room, said, I had to tell you. Right. They couldn't hold my sexuality over me. They couldn't hold that over my head because I told you. Right. And so there's a way in which not only being out, not only being, you know, clear about his suspicion around, you know, gender categories and the biting nature of his criticism of white supremacy. My goodness, Baldwin found himself in the crosshairs over and over again.
Well, this seems like the perfect time to hear a little bit more of you reading some of his work.
Sure.
So I'm wondering if we could dip into The White Man's Guilt. It was a 1965 essay that appeared in Ebony Magazine. Now, just a little bit of background here. 65, obviously, a standout year of, in its own right, right? We had Malcolm X was assassinated early that year in February, March. There was Selma, August, protests in Watts. And so that's the context that Baldwin's writing here in August of 1965. So could you read a little bit of that to us?
Yeah. White man, hear me. History, as nearly no one seems to know, is not merely something to be read. And it does not refer merely or even principally to the past. On the contrary, the great force of history comes from the fact that we carry it within us. And it is with great pain and terror that one begins to realize this. It's in great pain and terror because one enters into battle with that historical creation, oneself, and attempts to recreate oneself according to a principle more humane and more liberating.
So what do you draw from that?
You know, history's the great force of history, as Baldwin says, is that that we carry it with us. We are these historical creatures, right? We are carrying around with us all of the wounds, the pains, the traumas, the lies that, and joys and triumphs that make us who we are. And so it makes sense that when we have moments of crises, moments of challenge, reckoning, that at the heart of it are these historical choices that in some ways guide our eyes and our feet. And so when we think about this moment and our own moment, right, here we are watching for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, George Floyd murdered by the officer, the former officer Chauvin in Minneapolis. And suddenly protesters are tearing down statues. What's the connection? What's the relationship? What does public memory have to do with this brutal act? Right? Because history haunts. Its ghosts, right, shadow us. In some ways, the ghost of the 1960s, of the ghosts that have in some ways guided our politics for generations, are haunting out in the open now. And so Baldwin is insisting that we have to confront ourselves. We have to deal with the messiness of who we are. And that's going to involve a confrontation with our history, the stories that we tell.
It haunts us as individuals, and it's also incorporated into our institutions, right?
Yeah.
So I want to hear a little bit about how Baldwin sort of confronted that incorporation of history into American institutions. So this is a moment from 1969 when he was on Dick Cavett's popular television talk show, and here's what James Baldwin said.
I don't know what most white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know if white Christians hate Negroes or not, but I know that we have a Christian church which is white and a Christian church which is black. I know, as Malcolm X once put it, that the most segregated hour in American life is high noon on Sunday. That says a great deal for me about a Christian nation. It means that I can't afford to trust most white Christians and certainly cannot trust the Christian church. I don't know whether the labor unions and their bosses really hate me. That doesn't matter, but I know I'm not in their unions. I don't know if the real estate lobby is anything against black people, but I know the real estate lobbies keep me in the ghetto.
It's James Baldwin in 1969. Professor Gloud, what do you hear there?
Oh, I hear Baldwin's righteous indignation. You want me to trust that you're going to do something right? You want me to believe just on the face of your utterance that you're going to actually live up to what racial justice means? Oh, let's not just pay attention to your words. Let's look at your practices. Oh, let's look at the society that we've built. Oh, yes, you say you're committed to freedom. You say you're committed to liberty, justice, and equality. But let's look at the history of the country. Let's go to the record. Oh, Dr. King in 1963, at the Lincoln Memorial says, we come to what deal with a check that is bounced. Remember that? Right. That is, you know, that he's trying to deal with the fact that the country has not lived up to its principles. Baldwin in this moment is saying, you want me to trust you when everything about this world, everything about the country suggests that you don't extend to me basic dignity and standing. On what grounds should I trust you? He asks.
Well, when we come back, I'm going to ask you what the answer to that question ought to be. We're talking about the life and lessons of James Baldwin. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about some of the challenges that the country faces regarding the coronavirus pandemic. And as always, we are looking for solutions as well in terms of how do we get the best for people in the economy and how do we get communities healthy and safe all around us. So we want to hear from you. What are you witnessing in the city or town you live in? What are your family and friends sharing with you? Tell us your story or leave us your questions at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. You can also reach us via Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. And you can always continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Today, we are looking back at the life and legacy of James Baldwin, the writer, the playwright, the essayist, the astute observer of America and race relations from the 1960s all the way through his death in 1987. Eddie Gloud joins us. He's professor at Princeton University and author of the new book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. So, Professor Gloud, before the break, you had talked about James Baldwin saying, by what evidence could America provide that the country was worthy of his trust, right, as a black gay man? And so now I'll ask you two questions. One, did he ever have an answer to that? I mean, what would have been his answer to, here is how you can prove that the nation is worthy of our trust?
Well, I mean, in some ways, he calls for those of us who are committed to a more just America, a more just world, to fight to bring about what he would call a new Jerusalem. So, you know, at the end of The Fire Next Time, he says, you know, those relatively conscious whites and those relatively conscious blacks who, like lovers, must dare to risk everything to achieve our country, right? So it's in our hands, really. So it's nothing that the country could demonstrate per se. It's what we must do in transforming ourselves and transforming the country in the process. So I think his faith was always in us, but he was merciless in his description of the world that we inhabited and the world that we had built, if that makes sense. Hmm.
And is that your answer to that same question?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What I've found in the ruins and the rubble, as Jimmy described his body of work at the end of his life, that was of use, is, of course, the rage and the love, but this undying faith in the capacity of everyday ordinary people to transform their circumstances. He says that we're human beings are at once miracles and disasters. We have to do a lot to protect ourselves from the disasters that we've become, but we can be miraculous at times. And I think wherever human beings are, we have a chance at least. And so if we don't fall into the trap of the illusion of safety and innocence, if we risk everything right now in this moment, we have a chance to really reimagine America, but there's no guarantee.
Well, I want to take a tiny little tangent here because we've got an interesting question that's come in from one of our listeners. They want to know more. They want you to speak more about the aspects of Baldwin's message that were most controversial within the Black community. For example, the listener raises, how did folks react to his thoughts on the impact of racism on the racist?
Right. So, Langston Hughes and others thought that Baldwin was too, in the early days at least, was too preoccupied with white people. Right. So you look at the early criticism of, say, Amiri Baraka or Leroy Jones or Ishmael Reed or Eldridge Cleaver's biting criticism of Baldwin that was published in Soul on Ice. There is this sense that he's too preoccupied with white people, that he is concerned about what they think, that he's self-hating. And in this moment, the self-hating Negro is to be, discarded. And Eldridge Cleaver put the point even more crudely, that when he read Baldwin, right, he had never confronted someone who was as self-hating, that Baldwin desired the white man. He actually put it a little bit more crudely than that. I think that's a misunderstanding, a misreading of Jimmy in this early point where he was trying to be vulnerable. There's no way Black people could live in this place, a country organized in the way in which this country has been organized, and not have white supremacy take root in us. How it shapes our understanding of beauty, how it determines what we think is valuable. We come through this thing wounded, traumatized. And the question is, how do we interrogate it? What do we do with those wounds and trauma? But there was this sense that Baldwin was the white man's Negro, even as biting a critic as he was. Isn't that strange?
And also at the same time, you touched on this before, but I just want to sort of come back around to it. He lived a lot of his adult life outside of the United States. Mm-hmm. And people looked at that period as perhaps, correct me if I'm wrong, because this might be too crude of a way of putting it, but did he forfeit his right to be that kind of critic of the United States while living outside of it? Or that perhaps it had an impact on his art and his ability to clearly and forcefully articulate what he saw about America in the same way that he had done while he was living in the country?
Well, Baldwin left America in 1948 as a relatively young man. He departing the United States was really important because he said that if he stayed in the country, he was either going to get killed or he was going to kill somebody. The anger, the hatred that was in his spirit that he saw in his stepfather, he recognized was deeply and profoundly in himself. So he had to leave. He left and went to Paris and there engaged in this extraordinary act of self-creation. He willed himself into becoming one of America's most powerful writers. High school educated, right? I mean, we got to be clear about what coming from the ghetto of Harlem and what he achieved in that moment. But he realized once he left that he didn't leave America behind. He had to find the language, the culture, the rhythms that spoke to him. And that's the only way he could actually complete and finish Go Tell It on the Mountain. He needed the distance, the space to breathe in order to understand America. You know, it's so hard living in this place, you know. And what I mean by that is this, you know, people could watch, some Americans could watch the murder of George Floyd and go, oh my God, that's horrible, and then go about their day. Some of us have to watch it and then worry about our children. Worry about the people we love. Some of us have to deal with the ugliness of the country and then go to work and try to figure out how to keep our being unsettled, those 1,000 daily cuts that come with being Black in this country, to try to keep the rage from boiling over, to try to hold ourselves together. Sometimes you just need space to breathe so that we could just be. Baldwin found that space often outside of the country. Sometimes we just got to retreat into our spaces where people love us to death, so they allow us to laugh full belly laughs and to be rageful, right? And to not worry about the world at times, you know? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does. I don't have any other answer to that other than yes, it does. So look, I want to, there are so many lessons to for us as a nation and listeners to draw from what you're pointing to in Baldwin's life and writing. I want to, if I could, narrow our lens to you, Professor. If I may, for a moment, because I was reading some reviews of your book, and I mean, just I want to get that in the Wash. There's one in particular in the Washington Post that caught my attention. there's a graph there, and this takes us back to your view of the Obama presidency. Okay, right. So the reviewer says that you curtly dismiss Obama in biting asides sprinkled throughout the book. An odd choice, given that Baldwin's moral power derived in part from his ability to find common ground between 60s-era Black figures who sometimes launched vitriolic attacks against one another. I was just wondering what your response is to that.
He's wrong. I just find that to be a rather flat-footed reading. And I know Brother Ken and I went to graduate school together. He was in the history department. I was in the religion department. You know, I'm critical of
Mack,
I'm critical of the Obama administration. I'm clear about that. I hold to this view. I think that they could have been bolder. Once Mitch McConnell announced that the Obama administration should just be a one-term presidency, once he saw the way in which Republicans were behaving, that the idea of bipartisanship was an ideal that he could reach for, but he shouldn't bank is all on it, that I wanted him to go bolder, to change the frame, to get us out of the frame of Reaganism so that we can imagine the country anew. So I stand by my criticism of the Obama administration in that regard, particularly with what happened to Black America as a result of the Great Recession. We were catching hell, and we couldn't, and we're still catching hell. And because we were trying to protect his left flank or his right flank from the races that were coming at him, we couldn't really speak to the hell that we were catching. But I don't really dismiss Obama in that way. I don't make him an idol, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I treat him as a political figure that needs to be assessed in substantive ways. And part of what I want us to do is to understand what he represented, right? He represented this moment in which the country, could imagine itself otherwise, but then he became the basis of this extraordinary response. I mean, we vomited up Donald Trump as a result. I use that verb on purpose, by the way. So I don't agree with this idea that I'm dismissive and the like, but there are moments where I do speak my pain, right? Because I saw a lot of my friends become enamored with getting invitations to the White House. I saw a lot of folk who had prophetic voices who became court prophets, right? It's not enough to walk the corridors of power. We have to change the circumstances of people. And Baldwin wrote about this in The Evidence of Things Not Seen. This was his worry as he wrote about the Atlanta child murders, Magna. He said, what does it mean that all of these Black babies are being murdered in this city run by Black people? And that became the basis for an interrogation of what does it mean when we gain the reins of power and white supremacy still obtains.
Well, I want to return to it for a moment to hear Baldwin once again in his own voice, because this brings us to one of the biggest themes and phrases that, in fact, that your book addresses. So first of all, let's just listen to him. This is James Baldwin. He died in 1987, and this is from a PBS documentary that aired in 1989, but obviously you'll hear him here late in his life.
What is it you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here almost 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You always told me it takes time. It has taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress?
James Baldwin in 1987. So this brings us to this phrase, begin again.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
You know, in his last novel, Just Above My Head, which is an extraordinary novel, there's this moment that struck me. And, you know, and I'm a paraphrase, right? He says, you know, when the dream was shattered, people scattered. Some went mad, some were thrown in jail, some left the country. He says, but we know what we did, right? And then he says, but responsibility is not lost. Responsibility is abdicated. And if one refuses abdication, then one begins again. And it's there that I found the title of the book, right? And that is this ongoing commitment to pushing this damn boulder up the hill, trying to find the resources, right? For your children's sake and for your children's children's sake, to hold back despair and to keep fighting for New Jerusalem, to have faith in the capacity of human beings to love one another beyond the shibboleths, to look past the illusions, and to keep fighting. And so, you know, after King was assassinated, he had to pick up the pieces of himself and of us. And he had to figure out how he was going to speak to our condition. And then the country elected Reagan. Here we are in our moment, right? We have to figure out how to be different, how to live, to be together differently. Does that? And I have to find the energy and the resources to fight for that. I have to begin again. I have to do our first works over.
Is that always how it is? To do the first works over? I mean, to just bring Obama back in here. That is not how he saw it. The progress might be slow, but there was progress.
Well, you know, if we're tinkering around the edges in this country, we're going to leave in place this idea that Black folk, right, can be devalued. If we tinker around the edges, we're not going to uproot the belief that white people matter more than others. If we tinker around the edges, we're going to leave in place, right, all the things that devastate people. How long do we have to wait for your progress, as Jimmy said, right? We have to go back to where we began. So it's like me as a 51-year-old man. Right. If I'm going to change the way I live, I got to deal with, you know, my first works. I got to deal with the fact that my daddy deposited in my gut fear. And that I've been trying to prove since I was a boy that I'm not scared. I got to do my first works over. What does it mean for the nation to do its first works over? What did you intend to do when you set out? What were you saying when you gave voice to the principles of democracy? And what got in the way? Do your first works over.
Well, Eddie Gloud is the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. His new book is Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Professor Gloud, it's been a great, great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a delight. Take care and stay safe.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.